the Advanced Telecommunication Research Institute International, or ATR for short, is a major contributor to human-robot interaction research. It has the second highest number of publications at the HRI conference, only second to the Carnegie Mellon University. But what exactly is ATR?
It's hard to explain what ATR is. You know, people would ask me, oh, what is it? Is it a research lab? Is it a company? Is it part of a grad school? You know, my name is Dylan Gloss, and I worked at ATR for about 12 years. I was a group leader and a senior researcher there.
This is the Human-Robot Interaction Podcast. I am your host, Christoph Bartnick. So what exactly is ATR? More importantly, what is the history of their robotic work? In two podcast episodes, we will have a closer look at the people working there and the robots they created. We will also discuss what it means to work for a research lab like ATR in Japan. Maybe a good place to start understanding ATR is through their work. In 1986, ATR had four main telecommunication research topics: interpreting telephony, auditory and visual perception, communication systems, and optical and radio communication. The Communication Research Laboratory evolved into the Media Integration and Communication Laboratory, which then became the Media Information Science Laboratory. Out of this laboratory, the Intelligent Robotics and Communications Laboratory was founded. ATR was then structured into the Brain Information Communication Research Laboratory Group and the Social Media Research Laboratory Group. Today, we have the Computational Neuroscience Laboratory, the Deep Interaction Laboratory Group, the Wireless Communication Laboratory, and the Life Science Environment, Diet, and Agriculture Lab. Interestingly, some of the labs are named after their heads: the Hiroshi Ishiguro Laboratory and the Norihiro Hagita Laboratory. I'm not sure if you can take any more high-level buzzwords, so I will stop for now, but we will have a look at the ever-changing organization of ATR later. For now, let's talk about robots. The development of robotic hardware is a very visual and an easy-to-understand way to look at human-robot interaction. It does, however, not do justice to all the accomplishments, since much effort was spent developing and testing robotic behavior. So, how did it all start? Here's Professor Mishita Imai, who today works for the Keio University in Tokyo.
Maybe around 1998, we started the robot research, but ATR is a kind of the company related to NTT. NTT is a telephone company, so the main research target is communication. So especially our lot of laboratory focus on the telecommunication, virtual reality or a kind of that. So when we wanted to start robotic research, our boss said, ATR is not the research institute for robotics. So it was hard to get the robot at the time. So at first we bought a small tiny robot named Kepera, like this. And then after that, we persuaded our boss, and then they give us a robot, Pioneer, famous mobile robot. And while starting the robotic research, Hiroshi Ishiguro joined our project. And then he said to us, let's start the research of humanoid robot. But this is what around 1999. So we have no idea what we should do by using the humanoid robot. Hiroshi said, random behavior is okay. But we have no idea what kind of communication can be done by the random behavior. But while collaboration with Hiroshi, we developed the RoboBee, and then the RoboBee project started from at the time.
Yeah. It was Ishiguro sensei who started that, and I joined very early moment when, I mean, they built hardware and they were wondering how to develop software for that.
We all know Hiroshi Ishiguro, or we have at least seen a photograph of him. Or at least we think so, since you might have looked at his robotic doppelganger. Sometimes I'm not entirely sure on this, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to Takayuki Kanda, who now works for the Kyoto University.
Actually, I think it was 2000. I was graduated master course and worked for a Japanese company. And immediately I decided to quit that and come back to school. At the moment when I started ATR, it was slightly before my PhD. After working for company, I realized that I liked research.
But how did Hiroshi Ishiguro get involved in ATR?
The reason why Hiroshi joined our project is that we started robotic research. At that time, he was associate professor at Kyoto University. And then at that time, he moved to the Wakayama University. And then based on the movement, his movement towards another university, his boss worry about Hiroshi's research cannot continue. So his boss request us to have a work at ATR.
The importance of personal connections in Japan should not be underestimated. But let's talk about robots again. Please meet RoboVee, one of the most reliable social robots to date.
There are a couple of different moments. In the very beginning, we tried to make it all self-contained. So single robot having all sensors, all computers, and process everything. It worked well in the laboratory, but when we bring that robot to some real field, I think it was elementary school, we noticed it is too difficult for a single robot to operate.
They built RoboVee several years before I joined. By the time I was there, they had used it in a lot of experiments, but at the time it was still mostly keyboard control. So they were all little, you know, IJKM to drive it around, like remote control style. And they had these amazing setups with video screens, you know, like six video screens all tiled in a control room. And they used this keyboard interface. So one of the first things I did was to build out a graphical teleoperation interface for the robot for use in a lot of these experiments.
This is Dylan Glass, one of the main architects behind many of ATR's robots.
I actually worked with a lot of robots when I first joined, everything from building up a little cat robot from servo motors to another robot called RoboPal, which looks like a seat with a face on it. It was for elderly people. But the bulk of my work was done with RoboVee2 for the first several years that I was at ATR. And then the last 3 years I was there, I moved to the Androids. And I was working with Erica.
Let's take a break to thank the supporter of this episode of the Human-Robot Interaction Podcast, Furhat Robotics. Furhat is a social robot that communicates with us humans as we do with each other, by speaking, listening, showing emotions, and maintaining eye contact. Build interactions and experiences unlike any other with the world's most advanced social robotics platform. Follow the link in the description to find more about Furhat Robotics. Working on the lower levels of a robot can be rather difficult. How did the team progress?
And then over time, like by about 2007, we developed a system. It was called Interaction Composer. It's like a flowchart style software for designing social interactions with the robots. And this allowed, you know, different kinds of designers to come in and build much more complex behaviors for the robot, which took the place of an earlier system called Episode Editor, which was maybe not so accessible to non-programmers. But that's how we started building out some of the social autonomy of it. People could build out these really complicated sequences of behavior. Actually, one of my tasks was to make it easier and easier to script it. You know, when I first joined, at one point we wanted the robot to greet people in a slightly different way with some different words. And literally, at the time, the only way to do that was to go through one of the C++ programmers, one of the top programmers, and he had to go in and change the source code to change the way the robot spoke, right? And that's not scalable at all. And if you want to get maybe humanities people, like maybe they're researching some social thing, or get, you know, designers or authors to come in and create parts of the robot's behavior, it's important to have good interfaces for them.
If programming a standalone robot is difficult, how can you make it easier?
In that sense, next stage is more like networked. We start using sensors in the environment, and for difficult decisions, we put human operators. But it's more like a combination of such sensing system, some autonomy, but still difficulty to be solved by or helped by people. Almost everything was a problem in that sense. For example, at elementary school, where people are, it seems to be easy problem? No, it was not that easy. So, in the very beginning, robot didn't know whether there are a person in front of it or not. It was really difficult for the robot. And I mean, still, for a single robot, this is not that easy because of noise and changing background, changing lighting condition. But having sensors in the environment, detecting people come to be much easier. And knowing the location of people, and also, I mean, stably understanding environment, robots have much better capability for spatial interaction, moving around, talking to people like that.
And then around 2008, we did a big field experiment in Universal City Walk outside of Universal Studios in Osaka. And for that, we needed navigation. So we ended up, for that experiment, we developed a lot of autonomous navigation and localization techniques that we continued to use for later systems. We used external sensors at the time, so we set up poles around the environment with planar LiDARs that could scan pedestrians walking through, and so the robot could know where people were. But we did a lot of research on, you know, how do you approach people? How can you, you know, not get in people's way, right? So that was a big building blocks on the way to navigational autonomy for the robot. And then later, by about 2010, we were working in shopping malls. We had many robots at the same time running in a shopping mall for about 4 years. And so we focused on a lot of things like multiple robot coordination from a centralized server. And, you know, we could allocate certain robots to certain tasks. Like if one robot had a shopping cart and another one didn't, then, you know, the central server could decide which robots would help which people. So it became like a big networked kind of system. And then during that time, there were a lot of independent studies that developed specific models for interaction. So, you know, things like side-by-side walking, we did like many studies and a lot of research to look at, you know, socially appropriate ways to do that. There were other things like waiting outside shops. We developed like models so that the robot, if it's waiting, it's not standing in people's way, right? Another one was pointing to people in crowds. So, you know, you don't want to point directly at somebody because it's rude. So you can just sort of gesture slightly in that direction unless there's too many people, and then you have to be specific. So these are all like, I guess, HRI studies, right? But these models were things that people developed that we could then incorporate into the robot. With my multi-robot control stuff, the idea was, you know, you can start with one person operating one robot, but can you go to one person kind of helping five robots and eventually have like, you know, supervising a fleet and having very high autonomy?
Initially, we thought difficult decision to be made by humans. After studying for a while, we still have human operator for speech recognition. Maybe soon this come to be possible because, you know, I mean, there are some technology like Google speech recognition that come to be much better. I mean, performance of speech recognition is in proportion to the amount of data. So more data make this possible, but with researchers, laboratories, this scaling is not possible. I mean, decision making in reality, of course, I mean, in the very early moment of deployment, we put humans and I mean, let them supplement knowledge, but we learned that this is quite realistic and soon we can make kind of most of the necessary contents. But in our previous research, what we have found was one operator could operate four robots that move around and talk to people. At least what we have found was this is realistic. I mean, having one or I mean, small number of operators for large number of robots. I think we can improve that ratio more.
Did you ever consider using ROS for RoboV?
That was definitely a topic of discussion many times, you know, whether we should switch over to ROS. You know, but when I joined, ROS wasn't a thing yet, but gradually it became a bigger and bigger part of, you know, robotics in the world. And there are a lot of benefits to using that. But by then, we had so much infrastructure built that, you know, there's a question of, is it really worth switching things over? Is it worth the effort? And we did use ROS in a lot of studies, actually.
The team at ATR was in a way ahead of the crowd. They created much of the necessary frameworks before ROS became popular.
For some of my studies, we Velcroed a laptop onto the side of the robot and ran ROS on that laptop. And I made a custom interface so we could use that for locomotion and, you know, path planning, things like that, and localization. And for other studies, you know, people looked a lot into things like autonomous wheelchairs or semi-autonomous wheelchairs. And with those, you know, we didn't need all the functionality in RoboV, so we were able to use, you know, ROS for that. But in the end, it's a message passing framework, and, you know, it's about like how useful is it to reuse all those packages that are out there. And unfortunately, there's not a lot for social robots in particular. There's a lot of great stuff for navigation and localization and things.
How did all the people work together on such a big endeavor?
Structure might be a strong word. You know, whoever's contributing is just kind of contributing, and we didn't manage it or organize it very, very much. So it was a very organic process to build up that software. I would say twice while I was there, we did like kind of a major overhaul of going through removing modules that nobody uses anymore, restructuring things, cleaning it up. ATR is a really interesting place because it's such a crossroads. Like, you have researchers who only come for a couple of years. You have students who come and graduate and leave. And so many people are coming and contributing and leaving. So it's a very interesting development process, not very top down.
I feel ATR is like university laboratories. So next by each other, they sometimes help each other and maybe implicitly share some knowledge, but it's not that systematically.
And, you know, that has its benefits and its drawbacks as well, right? Like, the amount of code that got thrown away at ATR is huge because so many people would come for a short period of time, they'd leave, nobody would know what they did. And then, you know, their code like sits there for years and then it gets purged. And so, you know, there's something to be said for having, you know, a group of people well-organized doing something in depth. But you also, you know, having this cross-pollination with other research labs, you know, other kinds of people and even companies, I think there's a big benefit to that also.
My feeling, we are too busy to share knowledge precisely. So when we needed, we did, and we roughly know what others are doing. And of course, it's company in some sense, so we share our interest in each other in some sense. I mean, some group went well, then it helped ATR to survive.
Yeah, so the organization is pretty flat and fluid and not very top-down. So I think that the natural tendency of people is like you do your own experiment, you build your own tools, and then you don't worry about it. But over time, we had enough sort of people like me, people like the engineers I worked with, who were kind of involved in many different projects. And we started to see the commonalities of needs between these different robot you know, platforms or projects. Experiment research themes. And so over time, we started sharing a lot of the software or like building up things that can be shared between them. For example, I mentioned the teleoperation system that I built. I actually got that to work with like you know, many different robots, like probably 5 or 7 different types of robots, and we can use the same software to monitor them, or, you know, hit a remote stop or change the localization, things like that. So I started using that, you know, across the board. We also had things like the flowchart. It's called Interaction Composer. It's like this state transition flowchart system. We were able to use that with, like, I think 7 different robots. So even, like, we had, like, robotic wheelchairs, and we can program, you know, a path for them to drive around, and, like, a bunch of behaviors using the same software that we used with RoboVee. There are a few others. Like, we have this sensor middleware framework that can take, it can receive sensor data from different sources, and it can fuse it together. This is maybe sort of similar to a lot of the things you can do with ROS, but we built this middleware framework that can be used anywhere. So if you have we have a bunch of human tracking systems, right? Pedestrian tracking systems. We had a 3D one with Kinect sensors on the ceiling. We had a 2D one with planar laser rangefinders on poles. Sometimes we use a single Kinect or a couple of them in normal usage. And we made it so that they can all stream data in the same format to this middleware that we called Layer 2. And then we made a system so that people could build plugins for it. So now you can, like, smooth the sensor data, or you can do fusion between face recognition and laser-based tracking, or a fusion between audio sound source localization and visual tracking, right? This became super useful because we could just kind of plug everything into it and use the same framework in all of our experiments. So if someone is a researcher, they come in, they only care about one topic, they don't have to sit there and build up all the framework that's irrelevant to what they want to study. So I think that having that increased efficiency dramatically.
The hard work of the RoboVee team resulted in a very robust and reliable system. RoboVee is one of the first and very few robots to survive a primary school.
RoboVee has gone through so much in the field. Like, you have no idea, like, how many, you know, kids jumping onto it and you know, people banging into it and stuff. And, you know, we hired this guy. He's not really at ATR, but we hired him part-time to come in and fix RoboVee when it breaks. He was basically in the Japanese military, and you know, knows how to, like, fix tanks and stuff like that. So he would just come in, you know, for emergencies and, like, patch it up so we can, like, run it back out in the shopping mall. It was pretty extreme.
RoboVee has been around for many years, and it is a stable and mature platform.
I understand that people understand the robot project from its hardware. So different shape, different capability. No, it's not what I'm thinking about. So yeah, hardware, actually, I don't mind that much. So whether it's RoboVee or something like Pepper or Ashimo, whatever. I mean, I'm, in simple wording, more interested in brain of the robot. I mean, it's intelligent part, information processing. So yeah, if RoboVee is there and if its capability is enough for our purpose, we continue to use RoboVee. When we started RoboVee, I noticed, yeah, it have great hardware which is not really used. Still, I feel the same. It have still very great capability, and with our, let's say, artificial intelligence, we didn't fully use it. So until it come to be the boundary, probably we continue to use RoboVee. Well, maybe, I mean, thinking about a little bit of the future, probably thinking about commercialization, there will be cheaper robots, maybe less capable than what we have, like our RoboVees are. So in that sense, maybe as a research platform, it's enough. And I mean, yeah, I understand that some people think, oh, still it's RoboVee. No, I mean, we are always trying to improve its brain.
With RoboVee, I've seen moments where you see a truly, like, natural interaction. And one of the more interesting ones for me was, it was one of my early experiments. And I had people, there were people from inside the lab, so they know how the code works and stuff, but I had to have them do, like, the most boring task ever. It's like they had to ask directions to, like, 200 places in a shopping mall or something, and then a robot would respond. And it was one of those really boring experiments. And I was just watching through the video that I'd captured, and, like, some of the people knew about these behaviors that had been programmed into RoboVee since the early days, where, like, you touch it on the shoulder, like a touch sensor, and then it would, like, turn its head towards where you touched, and then you touch it on the arm and it'll turn its head down there. And I would see people just sort of, like, tapping on the robot to, like, mess with it while it's, like, trying to give directions to, you know, the bathroom or something. It was pretty funny, and it was kind of interesting to see that spontaneously emerge when, you know, when nobody else is watching, basically, and you're just, you know, you're just kind of messing with it like a little brother or something.
What I feel, Yeah, there are some advanced hardware platform for some research groups, or even everyone, there are already commercially available platform coming into the market. So in that sense, with that hardware, if we have great artificial intelligence, and I mean HRI knowledge, I think there are so much useful tasks robots can provide. In that sense, yeah, I feel it's more like software. And of course, I mean, software is not that simple. It's not about only programming. It's more about design. And I mean, knowledge about human beings and programming. Combining them is also very challenging, particularly seeing Japanese people. They are good at engineering, but they don't combine their knowledge with people from human science or designers. Integration seems so tough task.
The work on human-robot interaction continues, but its focus changed.
Recently, we are very much interested in moral aspect of human-robot interaction. I mean, like, how let people nicely treat robot. I mean, it's something like peer respect and also peer pressure, because I mean, we humans behave nicely each other if other people are nearby. But if there are robots nearby, do we behave good? Maybe no. But I mean, maybe robots fail to have some important capabilities that humans have. And I mean, if we think about nearby future where robots operate for many human-like roles, like shopkeepers, security guard, all of such tasks, we need such basic human capability about morality. I really hope to improve this capability for robots. And I mean, we are really running such a project, but I mean, it's still a research-based project. So if there are really unlimited amount of resources, I will try to do it much more. I mean, try to put robots in many real fields, and I mean, improve such morality capability. To my sense, ethical decision, if it's the direction we are talking about, maybe we need to invite human operators at some point. And if it is human who do most important decision, probably people will not complain. But I mean, the term morality, maybe it might invite misunderstanding, but I mean, I'm not really talking about moral agent and moral decision making. I mean, let's say it's more about perceived morality. So whether people feel robot is such moral agent or not, this is more important. So it's about interaction rather than artificial intelligence. I'm not only trying to solve negative aspect, but I mean, to provide positive roles, we need to cope with such negative aspect. Peer respect and peer pressure, these are a little bit different things. I mean, let's say try to make it survive as well as try to serve for that kind of negative aspect of pressure. But I mean, of course, this will be only possible if robots are useful, socially accepted. So in that sense, I mean, robots should be symbiotic. I mean, it offer useful merits to people and still try to get such benefit, or at least survive from bad behavior from humans. So nice harmonization is also very important.
ATR made an effort to commercialize RoboV and some of its underlying technology, such as a system to track crowds of people, is available. The next robots we are going to talk about have been built by Kokoro, an animatronics company in Japan. You can buy your personal robotic clone from them. And Hiroshi Ishiguro did. Hiroshi Ishiguro developed a series of highly human-like robots, and they were mainly copies of actual people. He started with creating a copy of his daughter, before making a robotic copy of a Japanese TV presenter. In 2006, Ishiguro Sensei made a robotic copy of himself, and this caught the attention of the world. Henrik Schaffer then also created a copy of himself, but the novelty had worn off. Creating robotic copies of humans had become a service that Kokoro sold to anybody with a big enough wallet. It is important to note that up to that point in time, all the androids were advanced puppets. They were remotely controlled by an operator. They were telepresence robots. Their autonomous behavior was rather limited. The next step was to develop an android that was largely autonomous. Meet Erica.
So this is 2014, and I was actually on vacation in Okinawa, and I got a phone call from Ishiguro-sensei, and he told me about this project, and he's like, yeah, I need somebody to build the software to run this android, and will you do it? And I was really excited. So I took the position, and they actually rolled me onto the project about 6 months before it really started. So I could have time to just build out the software frameworks, because I'd done this a couple times for robots like RoboV and the other robots. This was finally a chance for me, and I just built out all this framework. And then when they started the project, we had all sorts of researchers come on, and I helped them build in modules and fit those in. We were working together with teams from Osaka University and Kyoto University. And the Kyoto University team had almost no robotics experience. They were dialogue specialists. So they were the dialogue team, you know, and we were the robotic framework team. And then Osaka University was like, you know, applications. And so it was a very big project. I think it was like on the order of 50 people or something. We had some really big meetings and a few big demos. Yeah, I think, you know, knowing what you're doing and having it planned ahead helps get things moving in an efficient way so that you can get to the problems that are really interesting, right? So once you've got your motor control and you've got your emotion system or whatever, like now you got to make it do something cool. And that's what the interesting challenge is for social robots, I think. Like in a sense, I think this project was so important because, you know, Ishiguro-sensei is like so well known for all of his crazy robots he's built and stuff. But I think, you know, this was his real dream, was to build a fully autonomous android, you know, that can interact with people. And, you know, the other androids, they're so lifelike, but often they are, you know, telepresence applications or, you know, puppeteered, like you said. And so the aim with this is that she's going to be 100% autonomous. And there's no teleoperation or anything like that, which I think is what people are excited about for robots, right? They want robots to think and see them and react to them and have, you know, some level of cognition or something. So I feel like this was a really great step in the right direction.
So Erica was an attempt for a strong AI?
Well, you know, you got to start somewhere, and like, let's start simple. So, you know, we had this amazing team, you know, to do the dialogue, you know, from Kyoto University, and they did a lot of things like the speech recognition system and you know, aspects of the dialogue, state tracking, and you know, all that complexity. And then, you know, we're trying to, I guess, if you were to compare with RoboV, right? Like the experience of building an application or a demo for RoboV and building something for Erica is entirely different. Because with RoboV, it's so robotic, you know, it's like, oh, cool, it's driving around, or, you know, it sees me, or it's moving its arms. You know, it's like very mechanical, and it's kind of cool to see this device moving. But with Erica, you see her, and it's like you expect her to be socially aware. And there's a lot more emphasis on things like expressivity, emotion, and the dialogue content. And, you know, there are a lot of different studies, of course. It's a research lab, and Erica's kind of a platform. But, you know, some people just worked on, like, how expressive can we make her? You know, how much can we get her to, like, engage with a person, even if that's mostly scripted? And then other studies are about, like, can we get her to learn on the fly, to adapt her style to people as she's talking with them, things like that. So there's definitely, there were a lot of studies that involved learning, whether it's learning by imitation or adaptation in real time. When we started the project, Ishiguro-sensei described it as kind of a moonshot, you know, like we're trying to do this thing that nobody has done successfully, and it's very, very hard. So in that sense, yeah, by picking a big challenge, we're kind of setting ourselves up for a very rough road. But I think that without having that super, that very human-like form, it's difficult to get to the regime where you can measure, you know, analyze people's responses, you know, to the robot. Like, even though she looks very human, like they know she's a robot, right? So there's this negotiation that happens as people try to explore, okay, what can it recognize? What can it respond to? What can I say? And you see the same thing with RoboV, but it's usually in a different way where they're like, you know, in the shopping mall, the kids would be walking around it and like ducking down and like waving their hands in front of the eyes or yelling into the mic. You know, people are always trying to experiment with, you know, how they can interact with this robot and what its limits are. And with Erica, you see that on a different level. I think, you know, it's more dialogue focused and they're asking more complex questions and things like that.
Do highly human-like robots not elicit fear since they blur the lines between us humans and them machines?
Well, certainly, you know, the idea of feeling threatened by robots is pretty widespread in various capacities, right? And there's so many people talk about it all the time. I think that we're not there with Erica. I don't think anybody's afraid of her, but that's because I think she's not really integrated into real life yet. So there are different steps of realism, I think. And I'm always trying to break through those. So, you know, the hardest one for me is when you go up to interact with Erica and you start talking with her, there's this like fakeness to it, where it's like you're pretending like you're having a conversation with somebody, but you're not genuinely, you don't genuinely feel like you are. It's a little hard to explain maybe, but if you have a real reason or a real motivation to interact with the robot and you're interacting in an honest way, like you really are talking with her, like once you can get to that level, I think then you can really explore how people actually feel about these things. Because you're going to know that it's going to be below you on a cognitive level, but maybe it has capabilities you don't have or something. And then it becomes an exploration of that. But I feel like so many things, people come into it, whether it's an experiment or something, and it feels like a role play. And so there's a big challenge in how to break through that and get to the true interaction.
Can Erica be used in the wild, outside of the lab?
So Erica's actually more portable than she seems. Usually when we run her in the lab, she's connected up to like all these sensors and laptops around the room and stuff. But you can strip that down to be pretty simple, like, you know, just a couple of computers and maybe a Kinect sensor or something. And you can actually put her in different places. We've done a few field experiments in different places, but usually not the kind of public, unconstrained space that we would put RoboV in, because, you know, Erica's a much more protected robot and, you know, people would probably do weird stuff. So. But we had her set up at a bar one time and like had people come up and talk to her. Like it was within a company, but they had a little bar and that was kind of interesting. And they've done a few things that are more about, it's more of an exhibition type setup, but, I'm not aware of studies where they've actually had people just interact in a completely unconstrained way with her. There have been so many in the lab interactions, like people come almost every week to come talk with her. And, you know, some people like they don't, you know, it's not set up like an experiment in that sense. And people just kind of come in and like say stuff or whatever. And like some of those, I think, are on a much more natural level than if you're setting up an experiment and taking notes in the corner or something. So I think sometimes they are able to transcend that sort of invisible boundary. But I think it's going to be very difficult to do the real field experiments with her.
All the people that I interviewed for this episode have left ATR or have a second appointment at other organizations. ATR has gone through some dramatic changes over the years.
Like the first year or two that I was there, the library was still open and then they kind of closed it. And that was really sad, you know. And like they used to have these social events down in the cafeteria every month, I think. And it was just full of people and full of activity. So things got really quiet. And then the whole second floor, which was, I think, the language translation lab you were talking about, they all moved out to the research lab down the road. And suddenly, like, the second floor was just this vacant, you know, building. And it was really sad. But on the other hand, if you're testing navigational robots, it's kind of nice to have a whole abandoned floor because you can do all sorts of testing and stuff. So we took advantage of that as best we could.
In the next episode, we will discuss how and why ATR changed and what impact this had on the people working there. There is a lesson to be learned for all of us working in the highly competitive environment we call research.